Welcome to Jerusalem Unplugged, the only podcast dedicated to Jerusalem, its history, and its people. Your host, Roberto Mazza, will bring you guests discussing their relationship with the Holy City. A journey through history, society, feelings, and hopes for the future. Follow the podcast on all social media platforms at Jerusalem Unplugged.
Welcome to Jerusalem Unplugged, the podcast dedicated to Jerusalem, its history, and its people. I'm your host, Roberto Mazza, and today this is a special episode. I will take you with me on a trip, on a road trip from Beersheba to Jerusalem. In general, this is a trip that takes around an hour and 40 minutes at a good time, early in the morning, and it's about 120 kilometers long, around 70 miles. The trip is not an easy one, even though there's a motorway all the way from Beersheba to Jerusalem. Traffic, car accidents, congestion, and invisible lines that needs to be crossed, they all are part of the journey. So let's get started. I'm in Beersheba. And Beersheba is a very interesting place. Actually, not many people know about it. Just a few years ago, Beersheba got on the sort of European chronicles, very much because of a football game, when the giant Inter AC Milan lost a game in Beersheba, in a game of a Europa Cup. But other than that, it's often considered a neglected city in the periphery of southern Israel. Now, the history of Beersheba is a very interesting one. Bir Arsaba, Bir Saba in Arabic, is in Beersheba is the Hebrew name of a city. It's today one of the largest cities in the southern part of Israel, in the Negev, and is becoming a very attractive city, very much because it's getting better connected with the center, both Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, and the development of both the university, Ben Gurion University, and also of an entire area dedicated to high-tech companies. But let's take a step back. So here I'm starting my drive, and I'm just joining now road number 40, which will then turn into road number 6. So I'm leaving now Beersheba behind me. And as I mentioned, Beersheba goes back to biblical time. Really, we don't know much about it. It's mentioned in a number of scripture, but many archaeologists believe that actually the biblical site is what nowadays is called Tel Beersheba, which is a small town just a few kilometers away from the modern city. Now, the modern city of Beersheba was established by the Ottomans towards the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. The Ottomans realized that they needed some sort of a station in the desert in order to connect Palestine with other parts of the Ottoman Empire, and more importantly, to basically connect southern Palestine with the Suez Canal, so getting closer to the border with Egypt, that by then, by 1882, had been occupied by the British. The center is still visible. You know, if you travel to Beersheba, the old Ottoman city, unfortunately, has been neglected for decades, but you can certainly appreciate the Ottoman architecture, and is now known as the Old City. Around the Old City, actually, you can see the old Ottoman train station, and ironically, you get to see a statue of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk by the train station next to an Israeli and a Turkish flag. As I've been to Beersheba many times, what I notice is that often the Turkish flag disappears when the relationships between the two countries are at a lower point. And when things are back to normal, then the Turkish flag goes up. It's an interesting city, really. Not much has been written from an academic perspective. And as I said, Israelis too tend to neglect and forget Beersheba. It's often just mentioned as that place far away than periphery, like many others, to be honest. What is Beersheba now? Now, it's a city, obviously, with the largest majority of Jewish residents, which in 1948 was essentially taken over by Israeli forces. But before that, actually, I must say that Beersheba saw some fighting back during World War I, when in fact the British-led Australian forces in the famous Battle of Beersheba took over the city from the Ottomans. Just a few years back, the centennial was celebrated with a large presence of Australian, New Zealanders, as also British officials, also with the reenactment of the battles. And, you know, you can find all of this stuff on YouTube. There was a lot of attention. Eventually, if you're around Beersheba, you also will find an Australian park right in the middle of the city. But where things get complicated, sorry, I'm actually struggling here a little bit on the traffic. So things are complicated when we get to, you know, in 1948. So in 1948, what we have is what is known as the Battle of Beersheba, which took place in October of that year. And eventually the city was conquered by the Israel Defense Forces. Beersheba was taken over. It was considered a strategic point, particularly because Beersheba gave access to the rest of the Negev area, which for Ben Gurion was, you know, some sort of his dream to develop, you know, Israel. Maybe not everybody knows that, in fact, Ben Gurion is buried just a few miles outside Beersheba, in a small village, just out of a city. And again, you can see this kind of connection. Many should actually also remember that David Ben Gurion, while he was born in Russia, actually migrated to Ottoman Palestine in 1907, and eventually was educated in Palestine, and, you know, he took a degree in Istanbul, and he got to know very well the land of Palestine. And, you know, for him, the desert was this sort of avant-garde, where the new sort of Israeli, the new Jewish man, should have eventually settled. Obviously, things went rather differently, but, you know, just to give you a sense also of the importance of this city, particularly to the older generation of Zionists. Now, as I said, in 1948, the city was taken over by the Israeli forces, was occupied, the local Palestinian population was essentially kicked out, and drama following drama. Once the Palestinians had been essentially exiled, the city was used by the newly created state of Israel to accommodate Jews coming from the Arab world, Mizrahi Jews. As many probably know, you know, as a result of the state of as a result of the creation of the state of Israel, Jews in a number of Arab countries were expelled, and eventually, you know, they moved into Israel. But we have to deal with the fact that Israeli back then were mostly European Jews, either survivors of the Holocaust or, you know, previously immigrated into Palestine, so Ashkenazi Jews, who didn't really trust Arab Jews. They didn't trust them because essentially they were Arabs, and many Ashkenazi Jews didn't see major differences between, you know, these newly arrived immigrants and refugees and the Palestinians. And eventually it was decided to create camps or to move these Mizrahi Jews into peripheral cities, so away from the center, away from Tel Aviv, and away from West Jerusalem. So Beersheba became the center, largely inhabited by Mizrahi Jews. And you can still see that nowadays, even though there was a major change in the 1990s, at the very beginning of 1990, when there was this larger wave of immigration from Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union, where a number of Russian Jews moved to Beersheba. Once again, you know, Russian Jews were basically allocated places, either, you know, they were given new towns, but they were also moved into these peripheral cities like Beersheba. And nowadays you can see that. I mean, most of the supermarkets are run by Russians or, you know, medical clinics. And, you know, the rest of the city essentially is a Mizrahi city. with a large presence and a growing presence of Arab Bedouins. They normally live in the surrounding, but slowly they're moving into the city and certainly work in the city of Beersheba. But it must be said that there are actually no synagogues. There used to be the Ottoman synagogue, but it has been transformed into a museum. So in fact, for Muslim residents of Beersheba, this is a major issue. Beersheba is also home, as I said, to Ben Gurion University, which is a fairly big university. And I must say that in the recent years, probably in the last two decades, so a growing number of Palestinian citizens of Israel enrolling into different courses, and particularly from Bedouin towns. One that I'm actually approaching right now as I'm driving through the traffic, and I'm already a few kilometers out of Beersheba. The surrounding of Beersheba is quite impressive. It's all desert. And the moment you get out of the city, like right now, you can see Bedouins driving off the roads and taking the cattle around, the hills. And I'm approaching a big junction where there are plenty of roadworks. So, perhaps I'm going to take a break, listen a little bit to the radio before the next step, which is just open the window a little bit. I'm getting to the junction and stuck in traffic. It's a little bit of noise, as usual. And here I am. Now, on my left side is the town of Rahat, but on the right side, there is this entirely Jewish city, town, actually, better say, of Le'Avim. It's a village, Le'Avim. It's a very wealthy village, which was founded in 1983. It has a small population. I think there are no more than 7,000, maybe 8,000 people. And as I said, it's one of those towns created, to accommodate wealthy Israelis who often commute. In fact, there is the train station is just around the corner, and it serves both Le'Avim and Rahat. Now, Rahat is, a very interesting place. Rahat is a Bedouin city, which didn't exist basically until the 1970s, if I remember well. And before that, there was a town called El Uzail. And eventually the name was changed into Rahat. Rahat is essentially a collection of Bedouin tribes. I love to go around Rahat. I personally know a few people there, a couple of scholars working at Ben Gurion. And, it's this fascinating place which was eventually, brought together following Israeli policies where they tried to basically settle the nomads, forcing them into becoming, fully residential. And at the same time, Rahat developed opportunities. So it's always complicated here to judge. Certainly there's an element of force, but there's also an element of providing opportunities, particularly for women. Rahat is fairly famous for that. And, a number of projects being developed there, and of cooperations between different groups, and, giving opportunities, and also some Palestinians, NGOs work there. Obviously, Palestinian NGOs are part of the State of Israel. And it is always complicated, and I do apologize in advance. While driving, it's a little bit hard to find sometimes the right words to use. The point about Rahat is that it is the city that was created in 1972, and it has just a number of neighborhoods, and basically the neighborhoods do represent the various tribes. Some of them are mixed, but for the most part, the neighborhoods are there to represent these different Bedouin tribes. The town is very close to Beersheba, and as I said earlier, most of the people living in Rahat do actually work in Beersheba. But Rahat eventually became a household name, not only around Israel, but in many other countries, when the famous story of Soda Stream, which was kicked out essentially of the West Bank, opened up a new plant in Rahat. But let me give you a little bit of a background here. So SodaStream is probably this company that you all know, producing these machines that add basically CO2 to, water, and you can do any soda drink you want. And originally this company was based in the West Bank, and it was based on, it was built on an illegal settlement. And it received a lot of attention. You know, the company was very successful. And at the same time, I must say that also the BDS movement, so the boycott, disinvestment, sanction movement, started a strong campaign against, similar companies. Now, the leaders of SodaStream kind of admitted that BDS played some role, but obviously they didn't say that the reason why they left the West Bank was in fact the BDS. But I feel fairly confident to say that the BDS played a major role in, moving the factory from the original location in Mishra Dumemin, which is an illegal Jewish settlement in the occupied West Bank, to Rahat. Now, why they moved, and here this is another side of the story, obviously they tried to guarantee the jobs to the Palestinians working there. But eventually, the reality is that it's very hard for those Palestinians to cross the border of the West Bank, which they would do, geographically speaking, not far away from here, where you get the road leading to Hebron. And it's literally just a couple of minutes from here, from where I'm driving. Only a few of them eventually were given a permit. But more importantly, they found the energy to go across everyday checkpoints. And I think this is a very important point to highlight. On the other hand, the new factory provided jobs for the people of Rahat, for Bedouins, in particular women. I'm not here to judge, to question. I know there's a lot of questions about it, but I'm taking it from a perspective of a few people, as I said, that I know there, and they saw this move as problematic, but at the same time as an opportunity. Young Bedouins, particularly male, they found themselves literally sandwiched in between a very patriarchal and close culture and also Israeli control. And often, when people complain that Bedouins are running faster, with their cars around the area, and it's true. I mean, probably I'm going to bump into some of them right now. The criticism must be understood. I mean, the point is that they really found themselves like sandwich, completely compressed into these forces. And eventually, this is a way for them to express themselves, also to express their rage out of all of that control. And also you can see that with the control over women. And that's why this project of the opening a factory of SodaStream in Rahat, for many was very important. That just to give women a possibility to get out of a form of control. Yet the problem remains there. There are also problems related to accessibility and also questions related to, the fact that this is a Bedouin town, neglected. They don't get the same services as, Le'avim, which is just a few kilometers away. Not the same level of infrastructures in terms of roads, parks. These are all elements that have to be highlighted. I mean, we can't just hide behind, oh, look, SodaStream open in Rahat, this is good, and that's it. A lot of problem remains in that city. And, the junction's now behind me, and the last few years, essentially, road number 40 now joining into road number 6 has been fully, I don't know, how would you say that? Like, it's made into a highway. And so there are no longer like exits, so I can still see right now really the couple of gas stations that now are no longer directly connected to the road, but you need to leave the number 6 in order to get to them. So I'm now driving, and I guess the next city I'm gonna bump into before taking road number 3 and eventually road number 1 taking me to Jerusalem is the city of Kiryat Gat, which is another fascinating story. And so let's see, just let's take a break for another couple of minutes, listen to some of radio DJ music and see what they have to say. Okay, so I'm getting close to Kiryat Gat, so let's turn off the radio. And so my next step, as I said, is this city of Kiryat Gat. Now, Kiryat Gat is a new city, to be honest. I mean, it existed somehow in a different form and not really in the same area as it is nowadays. So Kiryat Gat was, I think, created in the 1950s. And it had a different name, a Ma'abara or something like that. And again, like Beersheba, the city was created in order to accommodate Moroccan families. So it's quite interesting if you're into accents, how you go through Kiryat Gat and the Hebrew they speak is heavily directed towards that accent. And the city was eventually founded on top of the ruins of a village, which was again depopulated in 1949, Iraq al-Manshia, even though Iraq al-Manshia remains in the outskirts of the main center. Eventually, Kiryat Gat saw some form of expansion, again, through the 1990s, the arrival of Russian Jews after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And I think nowadays is in the region of like maybe 60,000 people or so. What I found interesting is that, first of all, they call it Kiryat Gat using, an ancient name. Gat, which basically was the name of a Philistine city, in a sense was, again, to create like historical connection. But I must say that one of the most fascinating things about Kiryat Gat is that in the last decade or so, there have been a large number of excavations. And I think some archaeologists were trying to find ruins in order to prove like some sort of a Jewish presence. You know, sometimes archaeology in Israel works in that way. But they ended up actually excavating amazing Byzantine churches. And there is a great Byzantine mosaic that it was found in Kiryat Gat. So, sometimes you end up finding what you don't want. You know, in general, again, Kiryat Gat, very much like Beersheba. Beersheba is one of these neglected peripheral cities of Israel with a, high degree of unemployment. Sort of a lot of people are commuting either towards Tel Aviv or towards Ashkelon and Ashdod, working in the port cities, or working south in Beersheba. There is some signs now that Kiryat Gat is sort of moving forward, but it remains a very peripheral city of Israel, in the southern part of Israel. Just outside Kiryat Gat, then eventually there is this junction of these roads, I come to be there in just a few minutes, possibly. There's a bit of traffic around Kiryat Gat in general. It's a congested area. There's a lot of trucks moving up and down. There are a few junctions, again, junctions with Ashdod, Ashkelon, but also the road going into the occupied territories in Hebron. They're all around here. So you get a lot of traffic around here. Unfortunately, a lot of accidents too, which is one of the major issues in Israel are really road accidents, plenty, and unfortunately many are deadly. A lot of people just paying too much attention to the phone. In order to record this, I placed everything safely, but in the end, I can see people around, moving with the phones and stuff, so definitely not a safe one. So yeah, slowly, I'm making my way to road number 3. Just a few kilometers ahead, taking road number 3, essentially, it will take me just across the hills and getting closer to Jerusalem. And essentially, I will avoid going through, Ramla and Lod, other very interesting places. The Nesher factory, this huge monster, very close to the junction with number 1. So yeah, I'm getting close to to this junction, which eventually will take me to road number 1. We are going to take a short break. Thank you for listening. And remember to join our Facebook page, Twitter and Instagram account. If you have a story about Jerusalem that you want to share, or someone that you want me to interview, please get in touch. Enjoy the rest of the show. Okay, I'm here at the Sorek Junction, so I'm getting, number 3. Okay, this is going to be like one of those things that only maybe a few people can get, but there is a very, very interesting place. There is a military base on the right side, and it's called Tal Shahar. Now, I'm going to make here like one of those like educated guesses. I don't know if you are a Trekkie, if you like Star Trek, like I do, but in Star Trek you have these people called the Romulans, and the Romulans are essentially bad guys, I'd say, and sort of a militarized society. I guess he's the creator of Star Trek. I haven't looked at Israel for that, but nevertheless, the name is very interesting because it reminds the name of the secret police of the Romulan, the Tal Shiar. And here it is, a base, Tal Shahar. I just wonder if there's any connection. In the end, the writers sometimes take, they are sort of inspired by real name, and sometimes they make connections that maybe nobody, no one's gonna look at, and then all of a sudden I'm driving by this base, and then I think about it. Hey, it really sounds like, but maybe I'm wrong. But if anyone listening maybe has some information about it, just please let me know. I'd be very curious to see whether this was actually used as a basis for the name of that secret police. So I'm in a junction, and I'm going to cross the green line. Now, basically, what's going to happen right now, I'm just going to cross one of the numerous lines that I will cross on my way to Jerusalem. So the armistice agreement line, also known as Green Line, because basically, it was drawn with a green pen. And I'm getting close to a place which is, fascinating, but with a dramatic history, La Tru. There's a big junction here. There's going to be a little bit of traffic. Probably I'm going to be stuck for a few minutes. And let me see. I'm just going to open 1 second the window so that you get the sense of trucks, hitchhikers, looking, the usual. Sorry, but there will be plenty of this in Jerusalem. La Tru, gosh, La Tru, so many things to say about it. Every time I'm driving around here, I have really mixed feelings, and sometimes I stop because in La Tru, on my right side, driving essentially north, there is this monastery, a Trappist monastery, which is beautiful. But right in front of a Trappist monastery, you have a Tagar fort. Essentially, a Tagar fort was a police fort that was built during the British Mandate and now serves as the basis of an Israeli unit. And I must say that a few times driving around the Independence Day, I just stopped and stared at all of these tanks that were parked out of the base, and with all of these kids play on tanks. I mean, militarization of society is not unique to Israel, but it makes you wonder. It makes you wonder a lot, just to be around tanks, essentially. What does this teach to kids? But anyway, let's go back to La Tru. So La Tru is this hilltop, and it's literally in between the roads, leading to Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, so it's very close to Jerusalem. It's at the beginning of the hills. And in 1948, La Tru was the site of a huge and very fierce fight between the Jordanian forces and the Zionist forces. And eventually, the area was occupied by Jordanian forces, and it became a no man's land. That's why La Tru is literally in the middle. This tiny sort of area. And in 67, eventually was captured by Israeli forces who occupied, the rest of of the area. As I said, now there is this Trappist Abbey. There is a mini Israel park right the other side. I've never been, honestly, and I don't really plan to go ever. I don't know. I'm not a fan of that. And I found that the whole place is so complicated that even placing a mini Israel is a further complication to that. Latrun is an interesting place, and I always tell people that, you know, they should stop. The monastery offers like amazing views. It has its history on its own. And I think also, you know, it gives you like this sense of the road that you're gonna now take. Because once you pass the monastery, then basically I'm gonna turn right. And that's the road to Jerusalem, number one, which again is set on essentially on the same green line that I said earlier. This is a period, sorry, this is a place where there's a lot of history around here. You know, if you drive straight, you bump into other historical places. But as I said, I'm fascinated by Latrun. It used to be also the sites of a Crusader castle. And, you know, just as I said, it's not far away from Emmaus, a famous biblical, town where, according to the traditions, these two Jews, left Jerusalem after Jesus died. They were not aware of the resurrections, and eventually Jesus showed up to them. So it's all in this area. So there's a lot of stuff to see there. But it's also, you know, an area that saw a lot of fighting, particularly in 1947, 1948. So the monastery is relatively new, actually. It's been built in the late 19th century. The Ottoman used Latrun during World War I. But eventually, you know, it returned to be a monastery after the war, so the monks went back. As I said, what is interesting is that right in front of the monastery, you have this Tegart police fort. And there are quite a few around. Many have been converted to for other uses, but that's another interesting story. So during the Arab revolt between 36 and 39, the British began to build police forts, named after Tegart, who basically designed these forts. And, the idea was to place these police stations, 45 police stations, in key areas of Palestine, and, you know, in order to control people, mostly Palestinians, but also to control Zionist forces. And so, you know, you get to see one of them right here in Latrun. So, as I said, you know, also the Battle of Latrun is widely described in many works, and essentially, because this is like the way to Jerusalem, also you get to see how this was a very important battle, and eventually this is where the Jordanian and Zionist forces like sort of stopped, even though Zionist forces managed to get in, you know, through what nowadays is road number one, very close to Jerusalem, you know, up to the borders with the old city. So here I am. Obviously, there's a lot of things about road number one, which eventually, you know, was also known as Burma Road. But I'm just going to focus and drive now, because if you have ever been driving on road number one, despite the fact that it's been enlarged, so it's now three lanes, it's not an easy drive. You know, there's a lot of bends. It's both up and down, and again traffic, and, you know, people just driving really fast, and sometimes pay more attention to their phones. So I'm just gonna, you know, focus on the drive, and then see if I can give you some more information about what's going on the roads. So I'm on number one, and actually I just remembered that I'm driving close to a fascinating place, Abu Ghosh. Abu Ghosh is an Arab-Israeli town, just, you know, a few kilometers before Jerusalem. I think it's about 10 kilometers, 6 miles or so west of Jerusalem. And, you know, the name is basically called out of Kriyat Alinab, something like that. It's a mixed town. I mean, it has a lot of, history, also the presence of Christian communities, been there for a long time. And it's definitely considered one of the earliest areas of human inhabitation in Israel and Palestine. And, you know, plenty of archaeological excavations in the area suggesting that there have been people around at least for 7,000 years or so. So certainly a very, very interesting place just to visit. Also the Romans actually had a station in Abu Ghosh. It's just on the way. And sometimes I realize that there's so many fascinating places on the way to Jerusalem. And, you know, just like because of driving, I forget about them. But it's right there. And it's, as I said, it's Abu Ghosh control, certainly under the Ottomans, the route from Jaffa to Jerusalem, and essentially pilgrims had to go through them. And it's also one of the reasons why you have churches there, because there was a Christian presence. And, you know, basically these Christians living in Abu Ghosh would provide services for the pilgrims on the way to Jerusalem. During the British Mandate, if I remember well, you know, eventually the Abu Ghosh grew in size. And eventually, again, it suffered, obviously, because of the war of 47 and 48. The history of the city tells us that, during the war, Abu Ghosh essentially was the only Muslim village that remained neutral. The road was open for convoys. I'm not going here to judge anybody or, what people did and what they chose to do. But eventually, Abu Ghosh became a mixed city after 1948. Still, after the creation of the State of Israel, Abu Ghosh was often subjected to searches. Obviously, the IDF didn't really trust the people there. They thought that there would be infiltrators from the Jordanian side. And so it was not an easy life for villagers of Abu Ghosh. And, some now talk about Abu Ghosh as a model of coexistence. I need to breathe about this. I don't know. I have, my own views, but certainly it's true. I mean, communities do coexist fairly well in Abu Ghosh. So perhaps it might be a model, but as I said, I'm not in a position to judge. I'm just driving through, and I don't want to take any position on this. So I keep driving. There's a bit of traffic, lots of bends. Often Abu Ghosh is the site also of wildfires. And today, as I'm driving, there were quite a few, or at least smaller. But as I was listening to some news earlier, I heard that there might be problems. Now, I'm getting close to villages that were established, particularly after 48, to accommodate new Israeli settlers in the area. And here I am getting very close to, the end of road number one, which essentially then goes, keeps going, and it moves into, it moves into the West Bank eventually, up to Male Adumim, which is one of these settlements, illegal settlements in the West Bank. Well, I think it's the largest one. So I'm gonna leave number one and take this new road, which is named after Begin. And this is gonna be the sort of a new road providing access to the city center and also the old city of Jerusalem. It's a majestic new road, in fairness, because there is the new sort of a train line. So there is this amazing bridge on top. And at the same time, I'm going to go and drive past Lifta. Lifta is, one of those amazing Palestinian villages, which was depopulated in 1947, 1948, essentially was cleansed. And, some refer to Lifta as a Palestinian Pompeii. I'm not so sure I would use this because Pompeii was depopulated as a result of a natural disaster, but Lifta was depopulated as a result of human choice and war. But it's here on my right side. So I'm actually pleased there's a bit of traffic so I can look at the houses. And so Lifta nowadays is fully embedded into the city of Jerusalem. And it's this old, ancient town, which existed at least since the Iron Age, definitely through the Roman and Byzantine periods, also the Crusader, and obviously through the Ottoman era. Liftons were very proud of their own village. I remember reading a lot of material, particularly related to the early 1920s. Maybe by then, a small village of about 1,000 people or so, probably a little bit more, I really should have remembered while I was preparing this drive. But certainly I remember that in 1929, the Liftons played a role in the events that took place. I'm going to use the word massacres. Massacres were perpetrated on both sides. But to me, as a historian, I remember clearly that Liftons moved to Jerusalem and played a major role, also because they felt their village was under threat, and they acted as villagers. Now, by 1948, the village actually had some, was developing. I remember reading there were like coffee houses, not many, still very, very tiny, a few shops here and there. But eventually, it is again, because it was located on the road leading Jerusalem to Tel Aviv, so basically the road that I was just driving on, Jewish forces eventually, evacuated the Arab people, the Palestinians, women and children, and eventually they sort of placed their own command over there. Quite interestingly, it was never repopulated, and there are a lot of stories about it. Lifta was left on its own, and despite a few houses were blue, but eventually it was abandoned, and that's it. And essentially, really, between 1945 and 2021, you can walk around Lifta and some sort of jump back in time. I sometimes don't like these kind of expressions, but here it is. It's a ghost town. And you get all of a sense of, a Palestinian village which was cleansed in 1948. It was used, if I remember well, for some Jewish refugees which were hosted, in Lifta during the war in 48. But eventually, the living conditions were very difficult. Also, the place badly connected, and the buildings suffered from the war. Lack of sanitation, lack of electricity. So, the Jewish inhabitants that were placed in Lifta chose to leave a few years later. So it remains this sort of nature reserve, as the 1980s was declared. But for me, it also remains a ghost town. And the ghosts are very much those of the Palestinians that were expelled in 1948. And now, obviously, there's all issue about plans that were announced, I think, in 2011 or so, to demolish the village and rebuild the luxury development. But eventually, there were legal petitions. And so at the moment, all of these plans have been rejected or at least opposed. So, hopefully, there will be organizations that are going to save the houses of Lifta. And even though it would be hard to say that they're going to give back to the Palestinians, originally the inhabitants, but at least to keep it as a memory of that. So I'm getting close, and obviously now I am stuck in traffic. And so while it took me just 1 hour to get to the outskirts of Jerusalem, now it's going to take me at least 40 minutes to get to my final destination, which is a parking lot in East Jerusalem, right in front of a YMCA. And that's gonna be my final destination in this drive. Now, before I get there, as I said, yes, I need to go through a number of neighborhoods. Now, the new road essentially is basically designed to take me through mostly Orthodox Jewish neighborhoods. And eventually, it's a shortcut, honestly. It's kind of convenient. But again, I'm just going across lines of different neighbors, once again across the green line, so back and forth this line. And some of the oldest Jewish Orthodox neighborhood, you know, very close to Mea Shearim, essentially, the Bukharian quarter, so Jews that came from Bukhara in Uzbekistan. And eventually, you know, Shmuel HaChanavi, so I just gonna drive through that. It's not an easy drive. Roads here are a little bit narrower. There's a lot of traffic. You also have to pay attention to people walking, crossing the streets. And eventually I will just get out of, right in front of what is the American colony and, you know, just cross into East Jerusalem, so east of the Green Line. So, okay, they keep talking here on the Italian radio, and slowly, I'm here. You know, it's a slow drive, so I am just crossing, you know, these, I would say, ultra-Orthodox Jewish neighborhoods. You know, Google Maps just takes you through here. And here I am, right in front of the American colony. So now I'm going to take St. George Street. Now, what is interesting here is that in front of the American Colony Hotel, you have a set of hotels that were all being built in this no man's land. And I'm here in Sheikh Jarrah. So, you know, these neighborhoods have been at the center of the recent flare-up of violence. Jewish settlers, you know, trying to take over Palestinian houses here in East Jerusalem. So behind me, this is, you know, this area, which is fascinating. I mean, Sheikh Jarrah has a very fascinating history. It was this neighborhood that was built mainly by wealthy Muslim Jerusalemite residents at the end of the 19th century, and also then later on some Christian Palestinians joined their fellow Jerusalemites in this very nice area, right on a hill, you know, looking over the city. And we also have this very famous Jewish site, the tomb of Shimon HaTzadik, this Jewish prophet. Quite interestingly also, some Jews settled down here at the beginning of the 20th century, some coming from what now that is Iraq or Kuwait. You know, they were Ottomans, so they obviously moved freely through the Ottoman Empire. Some were wealthy, bought properties or mostly rented properties from, you know, local Jerusalemites. But you also had the arrival of some very poor Jews from Yemen who found refuge in the land owned by the American colony. Obviously, the situation nowadays is rather different, and, you know, particularly after 67, after, you know, the city was taken by Israeli forces, you had the drive by a number of Israeli settlers to use the law, a law that applies only to Jews and Israelis, to retake some of the properties there. Now, what, you know, this is a legal battle, but it's obviously bigger than a real estate problem. I mean, it would be just, you know, unfair to say that this is an issue about houses. It's bigger than that. But I'm not going into it. I'm just going to try to end this drive, where I, you know, try to give you a sense of where I am and the history of this place. And finally, I'm getting to the parking lot. So I've been driving through Nablus Road, first St. George's, and then Nablus Road, and here I am at the parking lot. There's a lot of things here. You know, the parking lot is essentially behind now what is the district court, so full Israeli presence in the area. I'm close to an Armenian ceramics shop, famous Balian, and, you know, in front of the YMCA here in Jerusalem. So I'm going to park the car, and my next stop is in East Jerusalem. But I hope you know you enjoyed this drive with sort of plenty of historical information, and also it was nice to feel that you are driving with me in this drive. And if you ever a chance to make a similar drive, you know, think about what's next to you. There's a lot of history, there's a lot of issues while driving. So thank you. I hope you're enjoying this special episode of Jerusalem Unplugged, and see you next time. Thank you for listening. Thank you for listening to Jerusalem Unplugged. This podcast is currently commercial free. There are no ads. The only possibility to stay this way is for you to please let your friends, your family, and others who may be interested in listening to Jerusalem Unplugged know about this podcast. Let's increase the audience and let's keep the podcast commercial free. Thank you for listening. Until the next one.